Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Ranking of the Stars, a podcast in which I, Jack Dielobablik, and my lovely, luscious, Lollapalooza wife...
Hi, I'm Emmeline Dielobablik.
...watch in chronological order every single movie that has won the Oscar for Best Picture, and this week's movie is...
My Fair Lady.
Alternate title... I'm a good girl, I am!
Yeah, that's exactly the voice.
Yep.
Ugh. You did it perfectly.
I know. I hate it. It's an okay poster.
Yeah,
I like it. It's very visually busy.
Yeah, I'm not... It's very pink, and I'm not entirely sure why.
A Pepto-Bismol, yeah. Shade of pink.
Yeah.
And then she's busting through and holding an umbrella, and there's some, like, blood pouring out of the umbrella, looks like.
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me.
Yep.
And then just a lot of characters and places. Yeah, it's very busy visually.
Yeah, a lot of visual potpourri. Very cluttered.
Yeah. But it's not bad.
No, not bad.
Could have been worse.
Yeah. Not bad at all.
Ready to jump into information about the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so this is an American... musical comedy drama.
American, but it's set in London.
I know, but it's made by an American company. So, American.
Cultural appropriation.
And it was adapted from the 1956 musical of the same title. It was directed by George Cukor, produced by Jack Warner for Warner Bros., and also distributed by Warner Bros. The release date of this movie was October 21st, 1964. The running time is 170 minutes.
About twice as long as it needs to be.
Yes. The budget at the time was $17 million, and the movie made over $72 million.
What did they spend $17 million on? The majority of this movie takes place in a single room.
I know, but there are a lot of extras.
Yeah, there's a lot of costumes.
There's lots of costumes, lots of extras.
It's ball.
Yeah.
They blew all their budget on the ball.
And all the musical numbers, too. Like, there are a lot of musical numbers with, like, a lot of people.
Most of the songs happen in that room. They are not extravagant productions. Which one are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of the song in the bar.
Yes.
I'm thinking of also the when they go to the horse race. I'm thinking of the ball.
Yeah, you're right.
Those were not cheap because there's over I'm sure that in each of these there's about 100 extra in each of the of those musical numbers.
Her dad does not know how to hold on to money, so he's just burning through the budget.
Yeah, exactly.
Can't take it with you.
Exactly. So, for characters and actors, we have Audrey Hepburn as Eliza Doolittle.
The legend herself.
Yeah, she was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. She's a pretty lady.
Yep. We have Rex Harrison as Professor Higgins. And he had already played the role in the musical.
Boo hiss.
Yeah, he's a returning actor for this specific production.
His songs are by far the worst because he's not actually singing. He's just talking in rhymes.
And yet, he's the one singing and doing all the songs. I'm gonna come back to that in the fun facts. All
right.
We have Stanley Holloway, who plays Alfred Doolittle.
The hero of this entire movie. far and away the best character.
And the best songs.
Yes, early contender for best male character of the decade.
We have Wilfred Hyde-White, who plays Colonel Hugh Pickering.
Colonel Pickering.
We have Gladys Cooper, who plays Mrs. Higgins. Jeremy Brett, who plays Freddie Eynsford Hill.
Was that the young gentleman they meet at the horse race?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the one who falls like very quickly in love with Eliza.
Yes.
The stalker.
Yes.
We'll come back to that.
Lust at first sight.
Yep. And Mona Washburn, who plays Mrs. Spears. She's Higgins' housekeeper.
Yep. The maid.
The maid. A few fun facts. There is only one song in the movie that is out of order compared to what it was in the musical. And that song is With a Little Bit of Luck. And it is the third song in the musical, and it was the fourth song in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
All the other songs are all in the same order than they were in the musical.
For some reason, that one. Yep. God knows why.
God knows why. Audrey Hepburn was dubbed by Marnie Nixon for all the musical numbers.
Is that Richard Nixon's wife?
I don't know, but what I
who
do,
are you?
What I do know is that Marnie Nixon was also the one who dubbed Natalie Wood in West Side Story.
Huh. So she just gets to sing all the songs but never appear on screen.
When you look her up, she doesn't have the face of somebody who would be on screen.
Not pretty enough.
Yeah.
I see.
The only time that we hear Hepburn's voice is in a song that's called Just You Wait. Harrison, on the other hand...
And when she's speaking normally, right?
Yes.
It didn't dub over her normal voice.
Harrison, who plays Professor Higgins, on the other hand, sang all his songs, and he refused to pre-record them because he said that when he played that role in the musical, he never sang the same song the same way twice.
Mm.
So...
Don't interfere with my art.
Yeah.
Oh, so he's just as pretentious in real life as he is in the movie.
That's what it sounds like, honestly. But it led to an innovation for the movie because they had to put a wireless microphone on him, and that was the first time that they used that.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's some pretty advanced tech for the time.
Yeah. First time it was ever used in a movie. Again, with a budget of $17 million, this is the most expensive film that was shot in the United States at the time.
Mm.
The movie was nominated for 12 Academy Awards, including Best Supporting Actor for Stanley Holloway, Best Supporting Actress for Gladys Cooper, Best Screenplay Based on Material from Another Medium, and Best Film Editing, and it won 8 Academy Awards for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor for Rex Harrison, Best Art Direction in Color, Best Cinematography in Color, Best Costume Design in Color, Best Scoring of Music, and Best Sound. No nomination for Audrey Hepburn.
I'm more incensed about Alfred not getting his due. This is a crime.
Yeah.
I guess he didn't have a little bit of luck.
He didn't have a little bit of luck on this one. There was a remake in the works in 2008, but it was never made.
Oh, no. Anyway.
What a shame. What a shame.
Oh, damn.
And the loser's bracket for that year includes Beckett.
Huh?
Doctor Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
I've seen that movie.
I have never seen it.
Have you seen the iconic shot of him riding the bomb on the way down?
I don't think so.
Yeehaw! He's riding it like a bull as it drops out of the plane.
Never seen it.
Yep.
Mary freaking Poppins!
Aww.
This is one of my favorite movies of all time.
There's a better timeline right next door.
Yeah.
Where Mary Poppins won.
And also, fun fact, Julie Andrews, who is Mary Poppins, played Eliza Doolittle in the musical. And the last contender here on the loser's bracket is Zorba the Greek.
What?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Huh? Zorba the what?
I mean,
what'd you call me?
My pick out of all these is Mary Poppins.
I've already seen Dr. Strangelove. Yeah, sure. Mary Poppins.
That's it for me.
That's it.
For now.
All right.
Your turn.
Oh, boy. Here we go. We open with static shots of flowers and soft music. Do you know what kind of flowers those were? I don't. You'd think with the amount of flowers I make.
I know. I'm...
Some kind of lotus?
No, not lotus.
Orchid?
Hydrangeas.
Hydrangeas?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were purple and blue.
Yeah.
Soft colors. And then we get the title in cursive script. This is fancy movie, pay attention.
Yep.
Sit up straight. Then we see a gaggle of high society men and women exiting a theater and trying to hail taxis to take them home. They call them taxis, but it's horse-drawn carriages. Because this is in yesteryear.
But they're also, like, modern cars, right?
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Yeah, they got trucks and stuff carrying around vegetables. All right. A little bit in the past. A much less well-to-do woman approaches the crowd as it begins to rain and attempts to sell them flowers. After her first successful sale, she sits at the base of a large column and is approached by a man who looks like Slugworth from Willy Wonka. Or Willem Dafoe, take your pick.
Yeah.
Old Slugworth. And she is told that there's a man on the other side of the column that's writing down every word she says, so be careful. The fear here is that it's a policeman who's going to arrest her for potentially being a prostitute.
Oh.
At least that's what
I mean, I got the idea that that people were afraid that she was going to get arrested, but I didn't think that it was because she was a prostitute. Clearly she was not selling herself, she was just selling flowers.
No, the flowers are just a cover.
Yeah. It's just a metaphor?
Yeah, just a metaphor. This woman selling flowers is Eliza Doolittle. This causes Eliza to start frantically shouting to the whole crowd that she ain't done nothing wrong and that she has a right to sell flowers, etc., etc. She just immediately loses her shit over this and just starts screaming at everybody.
Yeah, screaming and flailing around.
Which is Eliza's reaction to pretty much everything.
Yes.
Is to begin screaming and flailing. The man writing down her words hears the commotion and walks around the pillar, telling her to shut up. Does he look like a policeman? He's dressed like Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, he kind of does. He's got like a trench coat, and he walks and talks.
The deer stalker cap.
Yep. Yes.
Yep. Eliza demands to see what he wrote about her, and he shows her his notebook. We get a close-up shot of it, and it is indecipherable gibberish. He's writing in like phonetic symbols.
Mm-hmm.
Eliza begins to beg the gentleman she sold the flower to not let Higgins arrest her, and the man stands up for her. Other people in the crowd also get involved, and Higgins is the man who came around from the pillar, shows off by guessing where each person is from by their regional accents. Oh, you're from so-and-so, and oh, you're a long way from home, and oh, you must come from this place.
Mm-hmm. He even guesses the streets where they're from.
I can place you to within 5 feet of your street in London. Amazing. While he does so, Eliza continues to wail until he turns to her and tells her to stop her boo-hooing and leave. Women like her have no right to live. She should remember that she has a soul and the divine gift of articulate speech. An asshole from minute one.
Yeah, she's saying that she has no right to live. Like, fuck off.
Yeah. Don't sit there crooning like a bilious pigeon, he says. And so begins the first song of the movie, which is Higgins singing about how awful Eliza's speech is.
But also how awful people's speech in England is in general.
Here's a sampling of the lyrics. She should be taken out and hung for the cold-blooded murder of the English tongue. It's ow and garn that keep her in her place, not her wretched clothes and dirty face. There are places English simply disappears. In America, they haven't used it for many years.
I mean, he's kind of right about that.
How dare you?
You yourself tells me all the time that I speak English better than most native speakers.
That's for true.
So. Because I actually had to learn the rules and the accents and all that. Like, you guys are not taught your own language.
Nope.
So
we're just shooting from the hip over here.
Yeah. Mm. So apart from, the mean things that he says about Eliza, I kind of agreed with him about the fact that, British people or Americans don't know how to speak their own language.
Yeah, we don't follow rules. We just talk by instinct.
Yep.
We parrot the things we hear. After finishing his song, he tells the crowd that in 6 months, he could take Eliza and pass her off as a duchess at an embassy ball. Good sir, are you telling me that you could make it around the world in 80 days?
Mm-hmm.
These English people and their bets.
Yeah, they're like a good challenge.
Yep. He could even get her a job at a lady's shop, which requires even better English. What's that you said? Asks Eliza. That's right, you squashed cabbage leaf. You disgrace to the noble architecture of these columns, says Higgins. I could pass you off as the Queen of Sheba. The man Eliza sold a flower to jumps in and says anything is possible. He himself is a student of Indian dialects. Higgins is pleasantly surprised and asks if the man knows Colonel Pickering. I am Colonel Pickering, says the man. Who are you? Higgins says that he's Higgins, creator of the universal alphabet. Pickering is equally delighted because he came from India to meet him. Higgins invites him to stay at his mansion, and as the pair walk away together, Eliza tries to get Higgins to buy a flower. He rudely declines, and she kicks the basket she was carrying at him, which makes him change his mind and dump a handful of coins into it. Eliza then goes to hang out with the other street people, and together they sing the second song of the movie, Wouldn't It Be Lovely, which is a much, much better song.
Yeah.
I like this one a lot. All I want is a room somewhere, far away from the cold night air, and one big enormous chair. Oh, wouldn't it be lovely? And they're mispronouncing lovely because they're poor street peasants.
Yeah, so it sounds like they're saying loverly.
Loverly. Wouldn't it be loverly? And they just talk about wanting someone to love and, you know, food and basic survival things.
And remember, audience, in this song, Eliza wishes to have lots of chocolate.
Yes.
It will come back.
Chocolate is a central theme, yes. Eliza and her friends dance in the street and throw cabbages around. At the end of the song, Eliza gets in the back of a vegetable cart and is taken away. It's just a fucking truck full of vegetables. Like, not even in containers or anything, just raw-ass vegetables just bounce around this truck.
Yeah. For people who know London, this sequence is supposed to have taken place in Covent Garden.
Sure. The next scene starts in the town square before sunrise as the sky begins to lighten. Eliza's dad and his pals walk through the empty street, and he tells his chums that she should be along soon and will probably give him money for drink. They ask why she would do that, since he hasn't seen her for 5 months, and he replies that half a crown is a small thing to ask for all he's given her. And what have you given her? Everything. Life. London, the ability to see the sun and moon, and then he disappeared and left her on her own to enjoy it. He says, "Ugh."
I've only given her everything.
Yes, and then left her in peace to enjoy it. Then he walks up to a man laying on the back of a cart and says hello. Not a brass farthing, replies the man. He walks off and then says hello to a man coming out of a shop. Not a brass farthing, replies the man, and closes the door. Then we get a shot of the town square filling with people who freeze in place on cue when the music dings. They, like, a few people walk out, and it goes ding, and they freeze, and then another group will walk out, ding, and they'll freeze. Until the whole square is just full of people, and it's like the town waking up. It's people on their morning routine carrying boxes and going to work and stuff like that. Then they all start moving in at the same time. Then we jump to a group of people unloading flowers off a cart, which I'm pretty sure were all fake flowers. It's the same flowers that we saw in the opening, those blue hydrangeas, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, those fake-ass flowers. It was the way they moved. It wasn't natural. Eliza is one of the group unloading the flowers off the truck, and her father walks up and greets her. Not a brass farthing, she replies. Everybody's wise to his tricks. She ain't gonna take her hard-earned wages and let him pass them on to a bloody pub keeper.
Yep.
She says. He keeps pushing, though, and says he can't go home to her stepmother without some liquid protection. She gives in, and he says that she's a noble daughter. She then wanders over to a large group of people sitting in a circle and shelling peas together just in the street. They got this huge just shelling circle. And she eats one of the peas and then remembers Higgins' claim that he could pass her off as a duchess. She could be something more.
Yeah, she could be someone.
Yep. Must be more than this provincial life. Then we fade to Higgins' study as he takes a tuning fork and taps it against his desk, matching its pitch with his voice as a demonstration for Pickering. And he asks him, like, now how many vowel sounds did you hear on that? And Pickering guesses like 5, and he goes, "No, oh, actually, it was 120."
Yeah.
Then he turns on a large phonograph and makes a large droning noise, and he points at a phonetic chart to show what vowel sounds it's making. He's just going, and he points at a chart. Cut to Eliza entering the house, and the housekeeper asking what she's there for. Eliza says she's there to see the professor on business of a personal nature. The housekeeper goes into the study and tells Higgins that a very common girl has arrived requesting to see him. She doesn't look that bad. She's got a little...
No, she's well-dressed.
Yeah, she got a little dirt on her face, but wearing a dress, she's got a big-ass fancy hat, plumage on it. Send her in, he says, and turns on her recorder so he can get a sample of her ghastly accent.
Yeah.
He calls it.
That's why, before he asks for her to be sent in, he does ask the housekeeper if she speaks in a funny way, or if she speaks, if she's got a distinct accent.
He thinks it's someone else, because apparently he has someone with a specific accent coming to record. Mm. But it's somebody else. Eliza enters and tells Higgins she accepts his offer of lessons. Higgins doesn't want to, though, and so begins a 7-minute-long screeching argument about whether or not he'll teach her, and how much he'll be paid, and how dirty and lowborn and dirty she is. The conclusion of it all is that he'll teach her, and the final test will be the embassy ball. And if she passes, he'll set her up with a better job than she currently has. And if she fails, she dies.
Because he'll throw her out of his house.
He says the king will know and the king will have you beheaded.
Oh, good lord, I didn't notice this.
Yep. And I am going to play a sampling of the noise from this scene.
Oh, gosh.
So, audience, you can appreciate the level of just madness, acoustic madness that we had to endure for this movie.
Yeah, because she's always screaming like, ah!
Constant, never-ending screeching in this movie. Art! Who thought this was entertaining? Oh my god, so unbearable. It made me think of that that awful one from the Ziegfeld movie, except Eliza's the main character.
Yeah, so she doesn't disappear.
You know, you're gonna deal with this for 3 hours. So if she fails, she dies. And if she refuses this offer, she'll be the most ungrateful, wicked woman in London, and the angels will weep for her, he says. The housekeeper then takes her upstairs for a bath to clean off the filth while she wails, and that was audio from them trying to force her into the bath.
Yeah, because she did, well, it looks like she's never taken a bath because she doesn't know what to do.
She has this superstition about you'll catch a cold if you get water on you too much.
Mm.
So, yeah. They bring her into the bathroom. It's just, they already have a bath drawn and it's just steaming. And she goes, yeah, push me into a volcano. And then the whole room fills up with steam as they're fighting and clawing at her clothes.
Yeah.
And,
honestly, to be fair, I like a hot shower or a hot bath, but I wouldn't get into that. Like, if it was steaming that much, I probably wouldn't want to get into it either.
You gotta burn that dirt off.
Yeah.
And then it even cuts back to the study where Higgins and Pickering in, and she's screaming so fucking loud that they can hear her down on the first floor of the house. Oy.
And there's also, like, 3 maids that are, you know, around her trying to take her clothes off, so...
Yeah.
She's being attacked and unclothed against her will.
It's a group effort, yeah. And even the closed captioning at this point, it just says, "Continue screaming." Don't I know it. Pickering then tells Higgins he feels somewhat responsible for Eliza and wants assurance that she won't be taken advantage of. You're not going to touch her vagoo, are you?
Mm-hmm.
Is Higgins a man of good character when it comes to women? Do you know any man that has good character when it comes to women? Higgins replies. but he assures Pickering that he finds women a nuisance and is a confirmed bachelor for life. Then he sings a song about what a bad idea it is to let a woman in your life. Here is a sampling of the lyrics. Let a woman in your life, and you invite eternal strife. Let them buy their wedding bands for those anxious little hands. I'd be equally as willing for a dentist to be drilling than to ever let a woman in my life.
Yes.
Yep. At the end, he turns on all the phonographs in the room at the same time to simulate the incessant chatter of women as Pickering covers his ears.
Yeah, that was an unpleasant song because...
Mm-hmm. From an unpleasant man.
From an unpleasant man. All the stereotypes that he's throwing at the audience and at Pickering about what it looks like to have a woman in your life, it doesn't paint a pretty picture of women.
No, it's all the old stereotypes, like, oh, the old ball and chain, and all they care about is drama and clothes, yeah. And they're just gonna cause problems, and they can't keep their emotions under control. Yup.
You've been warned.
Yeah.
See what you let into your life.
Cut to Eliza's dad, as he and his pals are thrown out of a pub. Because he's run out of money. Send to build a Buckingham Palace, he says as he walks away.
He's great.
He's amazing. He's a wonderful, beautiful mess.
Yes.
And he just doesn't give a shit. They go and sit by some men who are digging a ditch in the street. I don't know what the hell they're doing.
Some plumbing, maybe?
I guess. And one of the pals says that they'll have to go back to work now to get more money. Fuck that, says Eliza's dad, and sings a song about how with a little bit of luck, other people will work for you. How old do you think he is? 50s, 60s?
I'd say, yeah, late 50s, early 60s.
He has a very weather-worn face, let's call it.
Yes.
And they do this little shuffling dance through the street, and it's so endearing because it's a drunk old man dance.
Yeah.
And his songs are far and away the best songs in the movie.
It's, you know, it's got a catchy tune, it's got a rhythm, so yeah. Nice.
Yeah, they actually have a tune, it's not just talking, like Higgins' songs are. With a little bit, with a little bit, with a little bit of luck, someone else will do the work. And it's all that kind of things, like, with a little bit of luck, women will not give you trouble, and with a little bit of work, a little bit of luck, your children will take care of you instead of you having to take care of them. And it's all about dodging responsibility and just being a shithead.
Yes.
But we've seen a lot of shitheads in these movies, but the difference about him is that
he's an endearing shithead.
He's a jolly shithead.
He's a jolly
and
shithead.
And he makes no qualms and doesn't try to hide the fact that he embraces it and is joyous about it.
Yeah.
You know? And one of the lyrics is, they're always throwing goodness at you, but with a little bit of luck, you can duck. Oh, amazing. After the song finishes, he's informed by Eliza's landlady,
yes.
I guess?
Yes.
That Eliza has moved in with a swell,
mm-hmm.
she calls him, and has asked for all her things to be sent over except her clothes. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Eliza's dad laughs and says he always knew that she had a career in front of her. And also, what is that thing he's wearing on his head? It's some kind of hat, but it's got like a... I don't even know what to call it. Like a thing that goes behind his head. Like a bill of a hat, but it goes down to his shoulders.
You ask me, I have no idea.
It's like a welding mask, but turned around. I don't know what the hell. He says that his occupation is a dustman, so it's probably some sort of, like, tool of the trade kind of thing.
Maybe. Oh, maybe he's a
chimney sweep. Yeah, that's what a dustman is, so it's some kind of thing to keep the dust off him somehow.
Yeah.
Then he sings a little bit more, and we jump to Higgins checking on Eliza as she practices making vowel sounds while strapped into a seismograph/lie detector-looking thing. It's, you know, how lie detectors have that little needle that goes back and forth,
mm-hmm.
and seismographs have the same thing. Yeah, she's making vowel noises, and she's supposed to match up, or make the needle match up with the
pre-recorded sound.
With the waveform on the other side, yeah, to know she's doing it right. And she's, like, locked into this thing. Like, it's an iron cage around her chest. Like a torture device. So he checks on that. He doesn't say anything to her. He just looks at the wave pattern she's making. And she's just sitting there going, "Hey! Hey!" Over and over. He then goes into his study, where the housekeeper tells him he's working her too hard. It simply can't go on. Making her say the alphabet over and over from sun up to sundown. When will it stop? When she does it properly, of course, he replies. Then a butler comes in and says there's a dustman downstairs to see him. A one Alfred P. Doolittle. Send the blackguard up, says Higgins. Pickering is worried it will be trouble, but Higgins is sure he can handle it. Eliza's dad comes in, and an incredibly drawn-out conversation begins, the ultimate result of which is dad getting 5 pounds. God, the conversations in this movie just drag on and on and on.
Yeah.
And they're circular and nothing gets accomplished. They have this whole spiel about, like, middle-class morality.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the dad's argument is that he's the most deserving because he's the most undeserving of it.
Yeah.
And he acknowledges that he's undeserving, and so that makes him deserving. And you could just see how fucking exhausting this is just from that explanation.
And the characters themselves look exhausted from that conversation, and we were exhausted from the conversation. Yeah. It just leads nowhere. It's trying to be clever, but it's more annoying than anything
else.
It's
just fucking exhausting. It just goes on way too long, and there's just no point to it.
Yeah.
And he ultimately gets 5 pounds out of Higgins. And Higgins offers to even give him more.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, "Oh, I'll give you 10 pounds," because Higgins is delighted with his rhetoric.
Yeah.
He's like, "Oh, you're the best moral philosopher I've ever encountered. You know, oh, a diamond in the rough, right?" And he offers him 10 pounds, but then her dad declines it and just says, "No, just give me the 5 like I asked for, because 10 is too much. And if I bring 10 back, my wife is going to want to save it instead of spend it."
Mm.
Oy. As he goes to leave with the money, Eliza comes into the room screeching that she won't say those vowels one more bloody time. She won't, she won't, she won't. Having a fit, like she always does. Her dad tells Higgins if he has any trouble with her to give her the strap, smacks her on the butt, and leaves.
Yeah, gross.
Yep. Yeah, fix up the strap, that's what she needs. Whack, yuck, 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 and he walks away. There's some rough edges to him that I don't appreciate.
Definitely smacking your daughter's butt is that's definitely one.
Yep, not great. And he also, during that exhausting conversation, Higgins thinks, "Oh, you're accusing me of trying to do improper things with your daughter." And her dad's reply to that is, "No, I don't. If I thought you were trying to do that, I'd ask for 50 pounds. Then Eliza and Higgins loudly argue about her continuing to practice vowel sounds, and Higgins tells her she'll get no lunch, no dinner, and no chocolates until she says them right, and he goes upstairs. Because that's during their initial argument about whether he's going to teach her or not, she storms out to leave, and he lures her back into the room by offering her chocolates.
Yes.
So that's how he always gets her to behave, is, "Eliza, chocolates," and he has, like, a little plate of them that he, like...
Yeah, he tells her that there's always chocolate being delivered to his house every day, there's just a shit ton of it, and she can have as much as she wants if she stays here.
Yeah, like, waves it under her nose.
Yeah.
Left alone, Eliza then sings a song about how he'll be sorry when she's famous and leaves him a fine.
That's Just You Wait.
Yep, the one song that she sung on her own.
Mm-hmm.
Just you wait, Henry Higgins, just you wait. And this song includes a fantasy sequence where the King of England comes out and declares a national holiday in Eliza's honor.
Yep.
After which the royal guard marches a blindfolded Higgins out and shoots him.
That's you do in a fantasy.
Yep.
That's what you do in a fantasy.
Eliza looks down in satisfaction at the imagined corpse, but then the real Higgins interrupts her fantasy by making a vowel sound at her. "Ay," he says from the top of the stairs. And then...
Did you notice that her accent changes in this song? Because at the beginning, instead of "just you wait," she says "just you white."
White.
And then by the end of the song, she says "just you wait."
I did not. I also, well, before I say that, we get a shot of her, of the carpet where the corpse was, and mm-hmm. it's gone, and she go like, oh, like she's surprised that it was a fantasy. Yeah. She forgot he wasn't actually dead. And then I didn't put it down in the synopsis, and I've forgotten where it happens in the movie, but there is some point where it's either her or the housekeeper says chili, the word chili, but they pronounce it chelai in the exact same way that Gigi pronounced selai. So that's just some Cockney accent or something.
I mean, that's also, you know, the same people who did Gigi were involved in writing the movie, so yeah.
Gotcha. It's their personal pronunciations.
I mean, when you think of it, like, My Fair Lady is a different story, but it's similar to Gigi as well.
It's in Europe. This is how they talk in Europe.
No, but also it's transforming a girl so that she could be acceptable to higher society.
Yeah, you're right. Making her a proper lady.
Yeah.
Can I be your lady? Eliza goes back to practice. Then we cut to pronunciation practice, where Higgins is trying to get Eliza to say the rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain. Surprise, surprise, she doesn't do it right, and he lectures her about it.
Yeah, the Rhine in Spain.
The Rhine in Spain
stays mainly in the plain.
I'm a good girl, I am.
You are a good girl.
Thank you. Next, he has her practice her H sounds by talking into a tube connected to a small flame. If she does it right, the flame will flare up because she's putting air into the flame.
Yep.
That's one of the best parts of the movie, just seeing all the weird-ass pronunciation machines he has. Mm-hmm. He gives her a piece of paper to read off while she practices, but she gets distracted and holds it too close to the flame and it catches fire. Nothing really comes of this, and then the servants, in a different room, start singing a song about poor Professor Higgins and all he has to put up with.
Poor Professor Higgins.
Yeah, and you get, like, shots of them looking over the banister and just talking about how from sunup to sunrise, look at what he has to put up with, and he gets no sleep and he gets no rest, and oh, it's just constant work.
At all hours of the day.
Yep. 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m. Yep. On he plods against all odds, they say. Then we get a scene of Higgins putting marbles in Eliza's mouth to help her with pronunciation, which also happens in The King's Speech,
mm-hmm.
which is also a Best Picture winner.
Yes.
Yep.
I believe so.
Yep. I know so. That exact same thing happens because The King's Speech is also about learning how to talk right. And the joke in this scene is she accidentally swallows one of the marbles. Womp womp. And he says, it's fine, I've got plenty more. The servants sing some more, and then we join Eliza and Higgins in the study late at night, trying the rain in Spain exercise again. I can't! I'm so tired! Wails Eliza, as Higgins sits with a hot bag pressed to his forehead, because he's got a headache. Pickering, in a plush robe and a newspaper draped over his face, says, for God's sake, it must be 3 a.m. Be reasonable.
Never.
He's always around when they're doing this, but he's never participating in the exercise, so he could just fucking go to bed. I don't know why.
Well, one thing that you omitted from the synopsis also is that Pickering is the one paying for all this.
Oh, I forgot that.
Because
he makes a bet with
Higgins.
Yeah.
That if by the end of the 6 months, she can pass as a duchess and he can, you know, teach her all that he wants to teach her, he will, he's paying for all of it. He's paying for her clothes. He's paying for the speech lessons. He's paying, you know, participating to the cost of, like, her living and feeding her for the 6 months.
So he's just protecting his investment?
I guess.
Yeah.
He's making sure that, I don't know what would be in his best interest, but he's got an interest into this situation, because either she fails and he doesn't owe anything or she succeeds and it's going to come out of his pocket.
He's making everything is proper.
Yep.
And that that Higgins is honorable around women.
Yeah.
Higgins says he is being reasonable and gives Eliza a pep talk about the majesty and grandeur of the English language. The greatest and most noble thoughts ever conceived have been expressed in its magical mixture of sounds. Milton, Shakespeare, all of them, in English. That's what she set out to conquer, and conquer it she will. Now try again. Eliza tries again, and does it perfectly, and that all three of them break out into triumphant song. The rain in Spain falls mainly in the plain. And then Higgins sits up and goes,
she did it!
Again! Again! The rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain. She's got it! By George, she's got it! And then they all start singing.
He says, by George, she's got it. George is not only the name of the king, but it's also the name of the director of this movie.
Afterwards, Higgins tells Pickering it's time to try Eliza out. He'll take her to the races. His mother has a box at Ascot. It will be her first true test. And also she dances with Higgins while they're singing. Important. Higgins and Pickering leave, and the housekeeper tells Eliza to go to bed. Eliza then sings a song instead about how excited she is. She says she could have danced all night and still begged for more.
Yep.
The song ends with Eliza in bed with a huge smile on her face, because she's living in Higgins' house while this all happens.
Mm-hmm.
She's been given her own room. She could have danced all night. Fade to black, and then we're at the racetrack, which turns out to be another Beetlejuice party where everyone is frozen in place. Beetlejuice party like American in Paris, everyone is wearing black and white outfits.
Yeah.
Except the party in American in Paris was it was a costume party, so everyone was in really crazy outfits. Here it's just your standard, you know, rich people dresses and ginormous hats, but it's all black and white, monochrome. They slowly come to life, and we watch them sing and dance for a while about how excited they are to be at the race. Then we cut to the various outrageous hats. We just get a montage of all the ridiculous, plumed, enormous hats that must weigh like 10 pounds apiece. Why do rich people love destroying their necks? Why is this the fashion? They've all got their lace umbrellas and their flowing gowns and their ginormous hats. After that, Higgins arrives and finds his mother in the crowd, and she is not happy to see him. As she knows what a prick he is.
Yeah.
What a disagreeable surprise, she says as he greets her. He explains the project with Eliza and assures her that she'll do fine here. She's been instructed to only talk about two subjects, the weather and everybody's health. Then Eliza arrives in her own outrageous hat, accompanied by Pickering. This is the iconic outfit that you see on posters, where she's got her own black and white, very form-fitting dress, and the giant plumed hat.
I mean, it's beautiful, but when you see how, like, it's super tight to her body, like, she looks like she barely has a body. She's so thin.
Yeah, she can barely move. She's got to like hold on to Pickering so she doesn't just topple over because it's so restrictive.
It's so tight.
Tiny little steps. A true lady only needs to breathe once every 5 minutes. She takes her seat in the circle of well-to-do gentlemen and ladies, and she does okay for a few minutes. Oh, she's very strained in her pronunciation, like you can tell she has to be very careful about what she's saying.
Well, it's not just pronunciation. He's also taught her intonation.
Yeah.
So she's trying to not just get the pronunciation right, but also get the same intonation that he taught her. Like, he definitely gave her a rhythm and a specific intonation where, like, how do you do?
Yes.
And so you can hear the, you know, where her voice is supposed to go up and where it's supposed to go down. And like for, what, a minute or something like that, everybody's just going around to her and like, how do you do?
How do you do? How do you do. Yeah, they just repeat at each other for a while. It feels very artificial.
Yeah.
And she even repeats the exercise at them. They try to talk about the weather. She goes, "The rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain." So she does okay for a few minutes until she starts talking about her aunt that she suspects was murdered over a straw hat and her father being an alcoholic. And they're like, "Oh, well, surely you're just joking." And she's, "No, I'm not." He shoved the alcohol down my aunt's throat. And she came to and bit the spoon in half. A gentleman tries to salvage the situation by announcing that the next race is about to start, so they better get their bets in. Everyone rises, and a young man offers to give Eliza his bet because she'll enjoy the race more if she has skin in the game. This is Freddy.
Yes.
And even while she's talking, he's like, "Oh, it's so delightful," because Higgins tries to cover for her and be like, "Oh, this is just the new small talk technique. She's just, you know, you're just not used to it yet." And he goes, "Oh, you're so good at it." She accepts the offer of taking the bet, and they all go to watch the race. And we never get to see the actual track.
No, this is see the people.
Yeah, it's a set. And you do see the horses go by very briefly, but you don't see the actual track. You just the box where they're waiting and the fake AstroTurf grass they're standing on.
Yeah.
So as the horses pass by, Eliza gets too excited cheering for the horse she has a bet on, and she yells for her horse to move its bloomin' arse!
That was brilliant.
Move your bloomin' arse! Higgins puts his face in his hands, and a woman in the crowd faints. Fade to the end of the race as everyone is leaving, and Higgins' mother telling him he can't be serious about taking that girl to the embassy ball. The only thing she's ready for is a barge, she says. Higgins is undeterred, though, and says that Eliza has become his and Pickering's whole life. He must see it through. Cut back to Higgins' mansion for a quick shot of Eliza, still in her fancy dress, sitting in the study looking sadly at the floor. And then we move outside to see the young man who gave her his bet approach the door with a bouquet of flowers. The housekeeper answers his knock, and he gives her the flowers for Eliza, and then sings about how beautiful and charming she was, and how he wants to bone her. This was like the most generic song I have ever heard. Like, the lyrics just went in one ear and out the other. It was just so bland.
He's talking about how good it feels to be on the street where she lives.
Yeah. The glory of just seeing you. It just sounds like every other love song you ever heard in a movie.
Forgettable.
Yes. It's just like love song, the love song. During his song, the housekeeper comes back out and informs him that Eliza has stated that she never wants to see anyone ever again. The young man says he'll wait, no matter how long it takes. Weeks, months, whatever. The housekeeper shrugs and goes back inside, and the song continues. Back inside, Pickering tells Higgins that they should call the whole thing off. There's no way he can prepare her for the ball in only 6 weeks. It can't be done. And he just continues to argue that way, and then we just jump to 6 weeks later while he's still making the same arguments. It was a clever transition.
Yeah.
Pickering is still making the same arguments as he and Higgins wait for the taxi to arrive to take them to the ball, and they're in tuxedos now. The only thing that really changes is their outfits.
Mm-hmm.
Higgins tells him to have a drink to calm his nerves, and Pickering says he doesn't need it. Where is it, though? He doesn't understand why Higgins is so stubborn about this whole thing. And Higgins tells him that creating someone by changing their language is the most important thing there is. It's how you bridge the unbridgeable gap between class and class, and soul to soul. Then Eliza descends the stairs in a different fancy dress, as well as a jewel necklace and tiara. This is a much more manageable one. Like, evening gown, not nearly as fancy and outrageous as the other one.
It's more flowy.
Yes, something you can actually move in. She's got white gloves on, and the jeweled tiara, her hair is all done up in a very special way.
She's got one of those, like, big necklaces also that cover your throat.
Yeah, choker.
Yeah.
Diamond choker. Yeah. Higgins and Pickering are both impressed. And after Higgins takes his own drink of alcohol to calm his nerves for courage, he offers Eliza his arm, and together they head off to the ball. And that is where we get the intermission. which, yeah, 3 hours, I guess, is the borderline for whether you get an intermission or not. And then during the intermission, we get the same flower background that we got for the opening. And then we come back to the ball, very reminiscent of how Ben-Hur came back from intermission and immediately got to the chariot race.
Yeah.
We are just immediately at the ball. The climax happens after the intermission. That is the structure of these things. The lords and ladies dance, and we see people entering and being announced. It's a huge, you know, marble ballroom. Everybody's in their fancy clothes, all different colors, jewels, flowing dresses, gentlemen in top hats. Audience, you know how it is. This is not our first rodeo with high society. And we see people entering and being announced. It's that kind of shindig. Higgins stands in the crowd and is approached by a man who asks if Higgins remembers him. No, says Higgins. Who the devil are you? The man says he's Zoltan Carpathy, Higgins' best pupil. He works as a translator for aristocrats now. He knows everyone in Europe, and no imposter can escape his detection. Ruh-roh, Raggy. Eliza then enters the room and is introduced as a cousin of Colonel Pickering. She enters with Pickering instead of with Higgins.
Yeah.
An old woman sees Eliza and tells Zoltan to find out who she is. Gladly, he says, but is intercepted by Higgins before he can talk to Eliza, and then trumpets blare out, announcing the arrival of Her Majesty the Queen of Transylvania. And Prince Gregor, and the crowd forms columns on each side so the queen and prince can walk down the center of them.
Mm-hmm.
The queen approaches Eliza, who kneels. The queen cups her chin.
She curtsies.
Curtsies, yes. Excuse me, I'm not, I am not of the upper crust. You have to remember I was born in a swamp.
And still, I love you.
So the queen cups her chin and says, charming. Very charming, and walks away. The crowd comes back together, and Zoltan manages to get close enough to Eliza to hear her speak. Eliza is then summoned by the queen, who is up sitting on a dais at that point, who tells her that the prince would like to dance with her, and they dance, which makes all the others start to dance as well. Sometime later, she dances with Higgins, and then with Zoltan. Then we see Zoltan whispering to the old woman who told him to find out who Eliza is. The whisper passes from person to person until it gets to Higgins, who hears the whisper and laughs uproariously out loud. Ah! He says when he hears it. We don't get to hear what the whisper is.
Yeah.
We just see it passing from person to person in the crowd.
Yeah.
Then we fade back to Higgins' study as Pickering announces that the evening was a total triumph. Absolutely superb. An immense achievement. And for this being the climax of the bet, I feel like barely anything happened at the ball. Like, she curtsies, she dances, Zoltan talks to her, and that's... It only lasts, like, less than 10 minutes for the whole thing.
Yeah, but I mean, they achieved what they set out to do at the beginning.
They did. I was just expecting more drama, I guess. More of a climax. Then he and Higgins sing about how they did it. They did it. They did it. You did it. You did it. You did it. I did it. I did it. And they just sing like that. While Eliza stands by silently. During the song, Higgins reveals that Zoltan came to the mistaken conclusion that Eliza was Hungarian, and all the servants laugh and sing bravo. The singing ends, and Higgins flops down into the chair behind his desk. Thank God that's all over, he says. Now I can go to bed without dreading tomorrow. The camera cuts to Eliza, stone-faced, and standing in the shadows. They have not even acknowledged her at all.
Yeah, they're just congratulating themselves and not even thinking of congratulating her for all the progress she's made and how she's changed. And no, she's just an object of study, and she's just somebody for them to mold into what they wanted her to be.
Yeah, she doesn't even exist. Everyone leaves, and Eliza is left alone. She takes a few shaky steps and collapses face first into a chair and weeps. Higgins then comes back looking for his slippers, and Eliza throws them at him and screams, "Here's your bloody slippers!" I know I don't matter. He asks what the devil is wrong, and she replies that nothing is wrong for him. She won his bet, but she doesn't matter. You presumptuous insect, says Higgins. You won my bet? I won it. Eliza screams and lunges at him, but he easily grabs her wrists and stops her. How dare you show your temper to me? Sit down and be quiet, he says, pushing her down on a sofa. Oh, what's to become of me? Wails Eliza. Why does that matter? Asks Higgins. You're just tired. Have a chocolate. No, yells Eliza. Oh, God, where am I to go? What am I to do? Higgins suggests she marry someone. When she's not crying, she's actually what he would call attractive. Ugh. Or if she doesn't want to do that, Pickering could set her up with a flower shop. Higgins tries to leave, but Eliza calls out and asks if her clothes belong to her or not. She doesn't want to be accused of stealing. Higgins says it doesn't matter. She can take the whole damn house if she wants. Except the jewelry that was rented. Eliza immediately takes the jewelry off and gives it to him. She also takes off the ring that belongs to Higgins and holds it out to him. He grabs it aggressively and she ducks and yells, "Don't you hit me!" Higgins is insulted she would even suggest he do such a thing and goes to bed. And as he walks up the stairs, he made some comment about before this whole drama started about asking Eliza to make a note to the housekeeper that he'll have coffee in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And as he's walking up, she says, "Oh, you better make that note or you're not going to get your coffee." And then he replies, "Damn the housekeeper, damn the coffee, and damn you." And goes to bed. Reminds me of the end of Gone with the Wind. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Yep. Very reminiscent of that. What is it with these love stories where the people hate each other?
They're not actually love stories?
No. The previous generation's conception of love is people who abuse each other, which is really depressing.
People who get together for the wrong reasons.
Yep. I don't remember her giving her this ring, do you? Because she said, "Oh, it's the ring you gave me at such and such a place." And I don't remember that happening.
I don't remember when she got it. But she still has it at the end of the argument because he actually throws it the fire.
She goes and picks it up.
And she goes and picks it up in the ashes.
Yep. I like, this was also her wailing about what's to become of her was very reminiscent of Lawrence of Arabia. Being part of two worlds but not belonging in either of them anymore, which is also the thing from Shogun.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm some kind of mutant now. You've created me and now I have no place to go.
Yeah.
An interesting dilemma that I don't really dig into too much. After he leaves, Eliza runs to the fireplace and digs the ring out of the ashes and puts it back on and cries. And then she sings a little bit of the "You'll Be Sorry, Professor Higgins" song. "Just you wait, Professor Higgins." Then we cut to outside where the young gentleman from the race track is still waiting and still singing. He's just always out there.
Yep.
Eliza comes out while he's going on and sings her own song after he approaches her about how the men she meets are all talk, and if you're in love, then show me. Think of this as the "just shut up and bone me in this alley" song. I'm tired of hearing about it. Show me. Show me, goddammit. Right here, right now. Bend me over this barrel.
Well, I mean, she's got a point, though. Like, cause she's been around Higgins and Pickering, and they're exactly what she said. They're all talk, and they don't really show anything to her about how they felt about her.
She's tired of it.
Yeah.
She's tired of hearing about the passion. She wants to feel it.
Yeah.
Make me feel something, goddammit.
Words can be good, but words are just words. There, sometimes you can make promises, that doesn't mean you're going to hold them.
You're saying, in the same way that a picture is worth 1,000 words, a penis is worth 1,000 words?
No, I'm not. That's your words, not mine.
Yep. At the end of that song, they catch a taxi, which takes them back to the town square where Eliza used to sell flowers. And the people there are still whistling the Wouldn't It Be Loverly song. She approaches and asks if she can warm her hands by the fire, and they don't recognize her, and someone sells her a flower. She doesn't belong in her old world anymore. And they're singing the song very softly, like almost under their breath. It was very, very nice, cozy scene.
Yeah. But sad too, because those are people that she knows, and that it's the place where she used to be, and even though she was poor,
she belonged.
She belonged with, she had a community.
Yep. And then they see her like, oh, what are you doing here, m'lady? And it's dangerous for a woman of your status to be out here at night.
Yeah.
They're very kind to her.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're very honorable street peasants. She then wanders down the street as the song plays in her head. It's her singing, just like echoing faintly. Until she runs into her father, who's dressed in a tailed coat and top hat. She asks why he's dressed up, and he tells her it's all that devil's fault. He tied him up and delivered him into the hands of middle-class morality. Who asked him to make a gentleman out of me? I was happy, I was free, now I'm tied neck and heels, he says. And this was actually, I did not notice on the first watch, but this was actually set up.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about with the the letter? Yeah, I did not catch that. So when Eliza's dad first shows up to get the 5 pounds, Higgins is being bugged by the housekeeper about a request by a man asking for a lecture on morals. And then after her dad leaves, he thinks her dad's a great moralist. So he has the housekeeper refer that guy who wants the speech to her dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so her dad actually took that offer up and is now rich because he's lecturing on morals.
Yep. He's lecturing on morals in front of the parliament and gentlemen.
Yeah, and the man who he got referred to died and left him £4,000 a month in his will.
Yeah.
So now he's rich. And I thought this actually, again, it went on too long, but it was an actual clever commentary about how rich people are way less happy than poor people. You know, insightful.
Yeah, they don't know what to do with their riches.
It's golden handcuffs.
Yeah.
Right? You know? And he said, like, I had no family members when I was poor, and now all of a sudden I have 50. They all come out of the wood. I was the one asking for a brass farthing, goddammit. Look what's happened. Then his pals come out to fetch him, because they need to be at the church in a few hours. He's marrying Eliza's stepmother. Eliza tells him good luck and leaves. We stay with her dad, though, and get to listen to his song about getting married, which I think is probably the best song in the whole movie.
Yes.
The chorus is, get me to the church on time. And some of the lyrics are, pull out the stopper, let's have a whopper, but get me to the church on time. Girls, come and kiss me and show me how you'll miss me, but get me to the church on time. And while this whole thing is happening, it's like the whole bar is just having a party and singing and laughing and dancing. It's a joyous occasion. Drug me and jail me, stamp me and mail me, but get me to the church on time. And he's like, he's walking across a piano. He's doing his little old drunk man dance. He's like hanging off the beer taps. This guy's great.
That's the best character.
He's a fucking mess and I love him. His little shuffling dance. And at the end, the crowd carries him away as if he's dead. He takes the pose you take in a coffin and even has a little flower he's holding. Because, you know, all the old ball and chain, he's getting married and they just...
Oh yeah, he's about to get a noose around his neck.
Yep, and they carry him away. God damn it. I think that's the last time we ever see him.
Yes.
What a glorious exit for a glorious character. This movie focused on the wrong character, goddammit.
We should have followed him the whole time.
I would have taken 4 hours with him. Then we jump back to Higgins' house, where he and Pickering are panicking about Eliza being gone. Oh, where is she? What will we do? They're realizing how much they miss her. Higgins says they should call the police. She belongs to him, after all. He paid £5 for her. Ugh.
Yeah, that was gross. 5 pounds. Is that the price of a living person?
That's about what he values her at.
Yeah.
Higgins then sings a song asking why women can't be like men. Why can't they be more logical? Why can't they just be chums and pals? In the same way that I label Eliza's song the Bang Me in This Alley song, the label for this song is Just Admit You're Gay, Higgins. Because he's like, why are men so much better than women? Why can't women just be like men? Men are so much more pleasant and easy to get along with and so handsome and attractive and, oh God, I just feel so safe and warm in their arms.
I didn't take it that way. I just took it as another misogynistic song where he's like, you know, women are in trouble. Once you invite them in your life, it's strife. Like, men are not like that.
It feels to me like he's covering for something. I don't think he's even really aware of it himself. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but
I think so. I think you're reading too much into it. I think this is just like a description of, you know, stereotypical men and how they're a lot more chill than women.
If it was just the hatred of women, it's the fact that he's singing the praises of men so much and how much better they are and how much more he enjoys their company specifically.
Yeah, because they can be more chill than women.
Yeah. Because they're not upset by the fact that he acts like a piece of shit all the time.
Exactly. He doesn't have to justify himself to other men.
Yep. Then we jump to Eliza at Higgins' mom's house being consoled about what a huge asshole Higgins and Pickering are for the way they've been treating her. She's like, oh, you did all this work and they didn't even congratulate you. You poor thing. Or Higgins' mom is completely on Eliza's side now.
Yeah.
Higgins arrives. He doesn't know she's there. He's just there to bitch at his mom about it. And oh, you're here. And his mom tells him to behave himself. You mean I have to put on my Sunday manners for this thing I created?
Mm.
He whines. Yup, says Mom. Then she asks Eliza how she ever learned manners with her son around, and Eliza says that if it weren't for Colonel Pickering, she never would have. He taught her that the difference between a lady and a flower girl is not how she behaves, but how she's treated. She will always be a flower girl to Professor Higgins, because he will always treat her like one. Upon hearing that, Higgins sits in a corner with his back to Eliza, arms crossed, and pouts like a little kid.
Yeah.
He puts his feet up on the chair and, like, huffs and, like, growls.
It's like he's being told for the first time that he's a prick.
Yeah, and he pouts. He pouts like a little child about it. It's, ugh.
He's like, how dare you tell me about myself?
Yep. Then Mom Higgins has to leave to meet a bishop, and on her way out, she suggests that Higgins stick to two subjects, the weather and his health. Higgins approaches Eliza and asks if she's done being foolish. She replies that he only wants her back to fetch his slippers and fetch and carry for him. I didn't say I wanted you back at all, he shoots back. He doesn't intend to change his manners. There's nothing wrong with them. He treats everyone the same. It's not a matter of if he treated her badly, but if she ever saw him treat anyone better.
Mm.
Eliza says she doesn't care how she's treated, but she won't be passed over. She even says, like, I don't care about getting a black eye. It's not like I haven't had one before. Ugh.
Oh, I didn't hear that the first time around.
Yep. She can get along without him. Don't think that she couldn't. I know you can, he replies. I always thought you could. But you've never supposed whether I could get along without you. He'll miss her, he says. He's learned something from her idiotic notions. He confesses that, humbly and gratefully. Even when he's complimenting her, he can't keep himself from insulting her.
Yep.
She says he has her voice on his gramophone, so when he feels lonely, he can turn it on. It has no feelings for him to hurt. I can't turn on your soul, though, he whispers. Ooh, you are a devil, she says through clenched teeth. What am I to come back for? For the fun of it, shouts Higgins. Eliza isn't having it and says that she isn't dirt under his feet. She doesn't want him as a romantic partner. She just wants kindness. Higgins says he wants that too, but then begins to insult her again, and Eliza gives up and says she'll marry Freddy and support him by teaching phonetics. She'll offer to be an assistant to Zoltan. And as she says this, there's a like saloon door in the wall of mm-hmm. the room they're in, and she goes through the saloon door and out into the garden.
Yep.
The walled garden. Higgins is incensed by the idea and charges out through the saloon doors after her and says if she takes one step in that direction, he'll wring her neck. I knew you'd hit me one day, she says triumphantly. Ugh.
It's almost like she's daring him to do it.
Yes, she's goading him. This whole thing, it's... On one hand, it was really well written, and both of them are making accurate points.
Yeah.
She's got much better of a point, and I agree with her, but he's also holding his own in the argument with, like, his point about, I treat everyone this way. You're taking it too personal. It's, manners are not about good or bad. He says manners are about having just...
That's about consistency.
Yes, consistency. It's just about having a way you act towards everyone. There's a give and take in the argument where he's finally admitting that he cares about her and that he can't get along without her, right? And he wants to be kind too, but he just can't let go of his pride. And so he keeps insulting her. And there's a really... realistic, like, ebb and flow to it.
Yeah.
And, like, an exhaustive quality that I've experienced in real arguments in my life with people, where, like, you just go in circles and you each make good points and you want to reach some compromise, but you can't because you're both hurt and can't extend peace to each other.
Yeah.
But then when they get out in the garden, it just starts turning sour with this, like, I knew you'd hit me one day, and her, like, trying to goad him into it, and it takes a turn. Higgins collapses into a chair and calls her an impudent hussy. There isn't an idea in her head or a word in her mouth that he hasn't put there.
Yep.
Ugh. Eliza replies by singing about how everything will be great without him. It's like, the world will spin without you, and the tides come and go without you, you aren't all that.
Yeah.
As she reaches the climax of her song, though, Higgins hijacks it and starts singing that he did it. He really did it. He said he'd make her a woman, and he did. She is a battleship, and strong, and a consort fit for a king, he says triumphantly. I like you this way. Goodbye, Professor Higgins, says Eliza, and leaves. And the movie should have ended there.
It really should have.
But it didn't. Mother! Screams Higgins, like a child, after Eliza leaves. What? Says his mother, rushing in. She's gone, he tells her. No shit, his mother replies. What did you expect? What is he to do? Do without her, I suppose. And so I shall, he shouts. It will be easy. He has his own spark of divine fire. He will be fine. And after he leaves, his mom says, good job, Eliza.
Yeah.
Yep. He leaves and sings a song while he walks home about how much he already misses Eliza. The song finishes at his door, and he goes into the now empty house and sadly turns on the recording of her voice as he sits in a chair. He just walks through, like, all the... and looks at all the machines that she used while she practiced and all the places they practiced, and now they're cold and empty and silent, and,
yeah.
And he's alone. So he turns on the recording of her voice and sits in a chair to listen to it. And while he listens, the real Eliza enters the room and turns off the recording, but says the next part of the recording. Higgins sits up a little bit and whispers, Eliza? And then slouches in his chair, puts his hat over his face and says, "Get my slippers, you dank bitch." The end.
He doesn't say the dank bitch part.
The end!
The end!
The end! What an awful ending.
Yeah, it would have been so much better if it ended when she left the mom's house.
Oh, left such a sour taste in my mouth. He treats her like absolute garbage through this entire movie. And then...
and she comes back begging for it.
Yeah, the conclusion of all that is that she walks back in and says, "Please, sir, treat me like trash some more."
Yeah, more. More!
There's no apology. There's no admittance of wrongdoing. There's no claim that he'll change his ways whatsoever. The way he slouches in the chair and just commands her to get his slippers was so fucking gross.
Yeah, so she's a servant.
It betrays everything that happened in that previous scene where she stood up for herself and said, like, "You have treated me like garbage and it's not okay and fuck you, goodbye." That was great.
I think that, you know, it's implicit, but what you could think is she doesn't actually leave the mom's house. She probably stays and then has a conversation with the mom she knows what kind of feelings have been arisen in her son. Like, he's definitely, he has feelings for Eliza and she can recognize that. But it's obviously, we don't see that happen.
You're right about all of that, but if there's no consequences for his actions, he's never going to change. Like, it's just going back to status quo at the end, and it's not a good feeling.
Oh, but that's not what the movie wants. Like, it's not the... he's not meant to change. I mean, he's already changed plenty, because at the beginning he was saying how awful it is to let a woman in your life, and then he let her in. So that's as much change as he can handle.
No, it's not enough.
I'm not saying that it's enough. I'm just saying that that's just what the movie is. It's she changed for the better. She, you know, became a lady, and all he had to do was just accept that he could let a lady in his life.
No, no, 1,000 times no. He's the villain of this movie.
I don't disagree.
And then he's a spoiled, petulant, arrogant child, and then he just gets his way at the end.
I mean, he gets his way through the entire movie.
Yeah, there's no consequence for anything he does, and he just treats everyone like crap. It sucks. I hate it.
I was definitely disappointed by the end of the movie. I was disappointed by the fact that, yeah, she did all the work. She made all the efforts. Like, I would have much preferred if the end of this movie was just her being settled as a, you know, in a flower shop and having a little better situation than what she had at the beginning, but still on her own. Like, if it would have been better to me if she was just making her way through the world on her own at the end.
Yes, this would have been a good movie if it had ended when she walked away.
Yeah.
The acknowledgement that he was a villain and that what he did was wrong and it wasn't right and she deserves better than that, and goodbye. The end. Do you believe her statement about how she doesn't want a romantic relationship with him?
I don't know, because when you see, you know, when they dance and then she sings a song about how she could have danced all night, like, you obviously understand that she's developing feelings.
Yeah, and his comment about how she's what he would even consider attractive.
Yeah, right? there are a lot of hints at the potential for a romantic relationship between the two of them. I don't know that that's what either of them actually wants, but it's hinted at.
And she says flat out that that's not what she wants when they're having that argument. But I don't know if that was just her being too proud to admit it.
I'm going to throw a stereotype here. You know how some people would say that you can only get this mad at somebody you love?
Oh, God. The passion. Yeah. If you don't scream at each other, it means you don't care.
That's why I said it's a stereotype.
Yeah. Yeah, because anger is the only way to express passion, right? Fucking idiots. Ugh. Man, all these romances of yesteryear are just fucking terrible.
I know, it just doesn't seem to me like any of them understand what love actually is.
No, they have the most warped and twisted view of it. It's really depressing.
Yeah, Gone with the Wind, Gigi, this one. We've seen a lot of examples of that, of just people who make each other miserable and at the same time somehow keep chasing each other.
Yep. I think it's just that this is how relationships work in Hollywood, and they're trying to validate, you know, their own shitty patterns by saying, oh, well, this is just how love is for everybody. Like, no, it's not.
Yeah, no.
Thank God it's not. Holy shit, are you guys okay? Because it doesn't seem like you're okay.
Yeah, what is it about people just making each other miserable all the time? Or wanting to change each other for no reason?
Yeah, just being awful towards each other. Yeah. You don't express pain. You don't express love by inflicting pain. That's not good.
Clearly, the way these movies are made, that's what their idea of love is.
So where is this going on your list?
Let's see.
And there's so much I cut out for the synopsis because those conversations drag on forever. Almost 3-hour movie. You could have easily cut out an entire hour out of this movie and lost absolutely nothing. Is it better than An American in Paris?
You have a knack for guessing where my eyes are. Because that's where mind I powers. Was.
Yep.
I
feel the cosmos.
I mean, it's all shitty, but I think I'm going to place this as going to be my new number 29 between An American in Paris and The Apartment.
The Apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not much better than The Apartment, but it's somehow it's a tiny bit better.
Took me a good 6 seconds to remember what The Apartment was.
Oh my goodness.
Not gonna lie. I had to dig around in the basement for that one. So nude number 29 for you.
Yeah. Hold on. And where is it going on your list?
For me, is this a better movie than All the King's Men? Yeah, just for her dad, it is. And probably for that same reason, I think it's better than An American in Paris, too.
Okie dokie.
Is it better than The Apartment? Yeah. Yeah, it is. Is it better than It Happened One Night? No. No. So I think this will be my new number 24. The only thing that gets it this high is her dad. If he was not in this movie, this would be, I think, in the bottom section.
Yeah, there are some good comic relief moments.
He was amazing. Get me to the church on time. He was a breath of fresh air in a just miasma of misery and hatred. Thank you, Alfred. Thank you. And our next movie is one you've been looking forward to for a long time.
Yes! The Sound of Music!
The Sound of Music!
Finally!
Another musical.
Finally! We've been dancing around. We could have had Mary Poppins for this episode. Julie Andrews was in My Fair Lady, the musical. We're finally getting to Julie Andrews.
The Sound of Music.
Yes.
Is this the first movie you've already seen that we watched?
Quite possibly, yes.
Yeah, I'd seen Casablanca before.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's the first movie on the list that, that I've seen before.
Wow. Took us this long. No.
That's going to be a good one. You're going to want to sing, too.
I hope so.
Yeah.
We've been in a real rough patch in the 60s. I'm ready for something good to happen. I'm ready for movies to be good again.
I mean, I'm not saying that all of it is good and that there are not shitty characters, but it's a very minor portion of the movie.
All right.
So, this is a...
The villain is not the main love interest.
No.
How?
No. No, because the villain is the Second World War in this movie, yeah. So...
Can't marry a war.
Can't marry a war.
Trust me, I've tried. It's impossible.
Yep.
Yeah, the 60s have not been living up to my expectations so far, I will say.
I thought it would be better than that.
I thought we'd be getting more counterculture stuff, honestly. But it seems like we're swinging hard in the other direction as a reaction to all the counterculture stuff.
Yeah.
Drugs? What's that?
Maybe the 70s will be better.
Anti-war movement? Huh? Never heard of it. Hippies? What? Huh? Let's go to our ball and think about high society. Just pretend it's not happening.
But for now, we got the Sound of Music to look forward to.
Yep. So, join us again in 2 weeks for that.
Yeah.
In the meantime, thanks everybody for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, that's it.